From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made several decades ago when a vision formed for a new way to teach Western New York about Native culture, art, and society. And let's face it, when many of us think about our Native American brothers and sisters, we think about cultures long past. But the history of, for example, the Seneca and the Haudenosaunee, it's a story that is thousands of years old and it continues today. On October 24th, at long last, the Seneca Art and Culture Center opens as a year-round multimedia facility, more than 17,000 square feet, featuring historical artifacts, pieces of art, exhibits, a detailed scale model of a longhouse. It's just the beginning. And this hour, we explore the history and culture with our guests. First of all, in studio, we have Peter Jemison, the historic site manager of Ganondagan. And Peter, congratulations on all of this. Nice to see you.
Thanks very much, Evan. It's nice to be here today.
Also on the line with us, we have got Michael Galbin, who is the Ganondagan historian. And Michael, thank you for taking the time for us.
Thank you, Evan. Happy to be here.
All right. Before we move into that discussion, a brief interlude to say hello to Jean Fisher, my colleague from down the hall. Hello, Jean.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me. And thank you to the folks who are listening today. I'm going to keep this brief because we've got a great conversation coming up that I want to listen to, as I know you do. So I just want to remind you that conversations like this and connections like this, talking about the new Seneca Arts and Cultural Center at Ganondagan, are made possible by listeners just like you who pick up the phone, they dial 1-800-295-9994. And that's a little different than the number you call to participate on the show. So let me urge you to maybe do it through your website. You could go to weos.org. You could go to wrur.org. You could go to wxxi.org. Lots of choices. Click on the support button. You can take a look at some of the thank you gifts that are available. Make that pledge of support on our secure and confidential website, and you will know for a fact that the dollars that you contribute, whether it's $5 a month, $10 a month, a one-time gift of $25 or $50, is going to make more Connections programs possible. It's going to make it possible for Evan to speak with an even wider range of people, although I don't know that that's possible. It will make it happen, and it's actually going to help make this conversation today possible. So, Evan, I'm going to let you get to this because it's something that I want to hear and I know listeners want to talk about. So let me just remind you one more time, weos.org, wrur.org, wxxi.org. Lots of possibilities, but please make your pledge of support for this wonderful programming. And thank you.
Thank you, Jean. And our listeners, if you're a listener every day or as much as you can, we really do need you. About 24 hours left in this campaign, and we have a long way to go. We do need you. All right, let's turn our attention to what's going on out at Ganondagan, and Peter Jemison and Michael Galbin are our guests here. Peter, on October 24th coming up, you've got a grand opening of sorts that, I said decades, well, how long in your own mind has this been a vision?
Well, we've been talking about this quite a bit and trying to figure it out. Some of us think it's been about 18 years. I would say for sure 15 years when sort of the money began to come in and we began to get down to, you know, really thinking about how would this building look and who would we have, you know, do the design for the building and things like that. Then it became a little more concrete, if you will.
Well, let me ask you and Michael then, what is your mission? What's your goal with the new Seneca Art and Culture Center?
Well, I think there are probably a number of goals, but let me just start by saying, you know, we now have an indoor facility which can handle many more people than we were previously able to. We have classroom space, we have auditorium space, we have a gallery space, we have a bank of offices for the people that work there, we have a very nice space for our gift shop. We have other facilities that, you know, augment the things that I've mentioned. And so these just didn't exist before, so they give us a much broader ability to present programming, to teach young people that come to visit us, to, you know, to reach out to people that may want to come as a tour group, you know, from some distant location. And, you know, we have a place for permanent exhibits and we have a place for changing exhibitions. So I think, in general, we're now having the ability to tell our story in a fuller way, to tell the story of the Seneca people. You know, there's a real focus on the 17th century because that's the time period of Ganondagan. But then there's a kind of a carrying it forward so that we come into the present and people understand that we're still here. We're still in the present.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I want to ask you and Michael about this specifically. I've been asking our listeners on Twitter if they feel like looking back at their own education growing up, do you feel like you were sufficiently educated about Native culture? And Brian, for example, writes to us, absolutely not, especially given history of our own region and area. Andrew says, not enough honesty about what was basically a genocide, sparse history of pre-Columbian tribes, and only good colonial stories. Vanessa writes, living in upstate, I felt like we were educated pretty well, but those who harmed Natives were glorified and their acts glossed over. Any surprise to you to hear that from our listeners, Peter?
No surprise. You know, my education, I would think, would be quite typical. I would say in the 50s and 60s, I honestly do not recall anything that was being taught in the public schools in a way that, you know, left an impact upon me. What I learned from family members, and what I learned later was really from my own, you know, specific interests, my own research, and my contact with other people, other Native people across the country.
Yeah, and so Michael Galbin, it shouldn't fall just to something like the Seneca Art and Culture Center to educate a population about history. What do you make of some of our listener comments, people who feel like they look back and they didn't get a complete picture?
I think it's fairly typical. I feel like it's a disservice to the to Americans to not fully understand, you know, how it came to be exactly that they're walking around in a city or a town or attending a public school in an American state, you know, and I feel like people approach us all the time, and that is their question, you know, how is it? First of all, where are the Native Americans? Secondly, why aren't they in front of me? Why don't I know they're here? And how did this all come about? And part of what we're able to do now in the new center is actually lay out that story in a way that makes it clear to someone who attends. It's also pretty evident to me that the need for that kind of education is very popular. Teachers recognize it and schools recognize it because, you know, we service thousands of fourth graders every year here, and the demand has not diminished. In fact, it's increased.
If you want to call the program, we'd love to take your questions, even the most basic. You heard Michael say, people say, where are the Native Americans? Mm. And Peter Jemison is always telling me, boy, let's not make it seem like it's only a story of the past. Mm-hmm. But if you've got any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Peter, where is Ganondagan, by the way, if people haven't been there?
Ganondagan is really about a mile south of the center of the village of Victor. The state route is actually State Route 444, that people take south from the center of Victor. Downtown, I mean, to make it more confusing, it's called Maple Avenue. Then it turns into State Route 444. But now the new building, we would go to the top of this very steep hill. There's a flashing red light. That is the intersection of State Route 444 and County Road 41. People will make a right on County Road 41. And about halfway down again, that very steep hill, there's an entrance now with a parking lot, and then our building sits back behind that. So we're basically a mile south of the village of Victor.
Okay, and if people want to attend on the grand opening, October 24th, which is, let's see here, that is next Saturday.
Yes.
What do they need to know, Peter?
Well, I think they need to know the programming will really start at 10 o'clock in the morning, but it will run until 5. And we're going to have a few things that will sort of repeat themselves, a combination of our storytellers, our dancers, and, you know, we'll be presented once, but then we'll repeat again in the afternoon, once in the morning, once in the afternoon. At 10 a.m., we'll do a kind of a bringing people into the building in a formal way, and, you know, letting people then see the parts of the building and look around. And we have going on in that same weekend a conference on basket making. You know, we have people that are still producing baskets out of the black ash splints. And so people who are making the baskets currently and people who are, you know, really interested in this and talk about it are coming together. And so we see something live and ongoing in the way in which we can use the building when people come to our event.
How did I do on the pronunciation of Haudenosaunee?
You did well.
Is that close?
That's good. And it's kind of the, I would call it the Onondaga way of pronouncing it. Haudenosaunee is kind of our way of pronouncing it. This is Onondaga-Gwena, language of the people of the Great Hill. But, you know, either works.
Okay. And yeah, I also want to ask Peter and Michael, we had some listeners saying, hey, send along a note of Happy Indigenous Peoples Day. We just passed Columbus Day. We did see the city of Portland and I think something like a dozen other American cities this year decide to change from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. And of course, that's been a question over a number of years. I asked, we reached out to the city of Rochester. They tell us there are no plans to change that. The city of Rochester still honors Columbus Day. Most local municipalities do as well. Peter, do you have a, is Indigenous Peoples Day a desirable goal? Do you have a preference on that? We talked about Columbus Day last year on this program, but what would you like to see happen with Columbus Day?
Well, you know, I think it's, first of all, somehow acknowledging the real story, the true story of things that occurred as a result of Columbus's visit. You know, there were changes that took place, not positive changes, changes that impacted the native population, you know, that really were very negative. And I mean, I think if people don't know that, they really, unfortunately, live in a little bit of a fantasy. And I know Americans like to preserve those fantasies, and so it's hard to, you know, bring about change. But, you know, there were papal bulls issued, which essentially opened up our lands to anyone who arrived here representing another nation, another country. And really, you know, it unfortunately became a kind of a war against non-Christians, people that, you know, had not received Christianity to that time period, and, you know, in an effort to impose that idea. So this is, you know, it's a complicated story. But it is a true story, and that's the part I would think I would love to have people learn more about.
Michael Galbin, do you prefer seeing Indigenous Peoples Day instead of Columbus Day, or any preference on what we do with that holiday?
Well, you know, in the United States, celebrations emerge and celebrations disappear. And my feelings on Columbus Day are that a lot of people, of Italian descent, use it as a celebration of their heritage, and I think that is a wonderful thing. Yet, Columbus should not be the person that you hinge your pride in, because we know, you know, as history tells us, of the atrocities that he personally committed and his men, and opened up a legacy of for us, for Native people, of you know, very painful story, and so I feel like if that was going to happen, that there would be a shift to an Indigenous Peoples Day, that it would be important to perhaps open up another opportunity for Italian Americans to celebrate their heritage, pride, and accomplishments that they have achieved. There are lots of states who simply do not accept and do not observe Columbus Day, and I feel like, you know, maybe it's a time to reimagine what these celebrations are really all about. And so I would love to see Columbus Day disappear and fade into the past. What it's replaced with, you know, I can't say what in my mind would be the best. But Indigenous Peoples Day doesn't sound too bad to me.
Well, it was strange to me last year. I mean, I'm always learning on this program from our great guests and the conversation of our audience. I didn't know just how strongly some, and I don't want to overgeneralize, some Italian Americans feel about the notion of Columbus Day being sort of one of their holidays. But I would never think that ending a Columbus Day celebration would be an attack on the Italian heritage. Not at all. I think there's other ways to celebrate. But Peter, last word on this before we move on to other things. Are you disappointed that Rochester, for example, tells us they've got no plans, they're not even thinking about it?
No, I'm not surprised, you know. And what I, you know, maybe you know or recall, Evan, I lived in the city of Siena in Italy. And for me, fortunately, what I was doing while I was there was really learning about the Renaissance and learning about the art of the Renaissance. And those are amazing achievements. The buildings, the sculpture, the art are amazing achievements. If you see them in person, you can't help but be awed by them. And I think some people don't even know, you know, don't even know those connections, perhaps. And so when we are talking about a celebration, what is it that you're actually celebrating, you know? I mean, try to have some impression of what it is that the Italian people and that country contributed, you know, to the world.
Shane on Twitter says, I definitely don't think that we were educated comprehensively enough about Native culture, and that's the reason why we placed a heavy emphasis on it when we homeschooled our oldest through grade four. So interesting to hear that from a listener named Shane. And then Ralph Benefits, local company on Twitter, tells us, hey, it's a beautiful weekend to hike through this treasure and discover the Three Sisters. I ate one last night. I think I'm in Peter and Michael, I apologize in advance. I think it's Dion Heathco, or is that close? What is it? The Three Sisters is a...
It's Hatiwin Danon de Joheco. Joheco is they sustain us. Hatiwin Danon de Joheco, meaning these foods sustain us. And you're referring to, well, like the Three Sisters.
Corn,
beans, and squash.
Corn, beans, and squash. It is a great time of year for the Three Sisters. And that was a totally mangled pronunciation. So thank you, Peter. Let me grab a phone call. Steve in Rochester wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Steve.
I think it's really up to us to educate our children. My son and I have been splitting wood ever since he's been little. We had great conversations outside on a fall afternoon doing that. And then we had one completely politically incorrect conversation where we're talking about the different races. Black guys playing basketball and not playing hockey and all these kind of things where, you know, anybody listening to us would have thought it was completely politically incorrect, and it was. But then he turned to me and he said, you know, what do you think is the attribute of the white man in the world? And I stopped and I said, Stephen, I would have to tell you, honestly, it's treachery. I said, because when you look at what the white man has done world over, is he has invaded other indigenous people's lands and committed genocide. And if you were to look at Andrew Jackson, you would have to, in all honesty, say he was an American Hitler, right? So, you know, that would be my honest answer to you. I don't know what you're going to learn in school, you know, but that's my opinion. So we'll take your answer off the air, but I just thought I'd offer that.
Stephen Rochester, thanks for the phone call. Michael Galbin, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think about race differently maybe than anyone else, and that many would agree that white is not a race necessarily. It's a skin color, and not even an accurate one. But I feel like it's not a basis. People shouldn't view history from that kind of perspective. I feel like it's more important to look at the way societies have been created and what their value systems are. And certainly European systems based on consumption and commerce and business exploit land and around the world. They have exploited indigenous people and their lands and transformed the landscape and the natural resources into commodities. And that, I think, is the way to look at it. It's also too generalizing when you talk about, white as a race. I just don't adhere to that. I think culture, the values, worldview of a culture really supersedes any skin color.
Peter Jemison?
Yeah, well, in our exhibit, we talk about, in our gallery, we look at the role of the Dutch, we look at the role of the English, we look at the role of the French, and the impact that they had upon our way of life and bringing the monetary system into our presence. And, so it really, again, it's the cultural differences, it's the mercantile system, it's the commerce system that, you know, we understood the idea of trade. We were engaged in trade prior to the arrival of Europeans, but with the arrival of Europeans, there became a different notion, and different demands were placed upon us in order for us to take advantage of items that the Europeans were bringing into our midst. So it's a complicated story, but it's one that it's still valid today. I mean, people can still see how interconnected various societies are because of cultural tradition and trade.
We have a lot of phone calls and listener input and questions and comments. And every time Peter's here, we ought to do this more often, Peter, because I think this sort of educational opportunity is really eye-opening. Here's a little pushback from a listener named Bruce. And I know that Peter and Michael have heard this line of argument before. Let me put it out there and we'll see what they say. Bruce writes, well, the truth about Native Americans is that they also took land, belongings, and even people when they wanted to, that they were not some idealized coexisting peaceniks. We came in and played the same game on a bigger scale and won. That is the fact of history. But even conquerors have a responsibility to the conquered to bring the people they have conquered into their society. And I admit we have failed at that, but separation is not the answer. I can see them having governments along the lines of counties, etc. But if they want to be a separate country, then we need to really separate them. Border crossings, guards, tariffs. We cannot have these sort of countries in our country. They cannot be American when it suits them and say, no, we are separate when it suits them as well. All right, Michael Galbin, what do you make of that?
Well, I've heard that many, many times. And, you know, to compare, to make comparisons, I think is just unfair. The type of empire building and expansionism and colonization, there is no comparison really in North America. That's not to excuse any other, you know, wars that took place, conflicts that took place. But as to give you a sense of this all, the Haudenosaunee people combined under a law based on peace, and that peace had to be worked at. It wasn't something which simply occurred. So even though things happened, the goal is peace. And certainly in relations to Europeans, to simply have a recognition of sovereignty, mutual sovereignty, and to not interfere with one another's course in life. And I feel like those ideas and ideals are a goal, and that takes time, effort, thought, and consideration. So I feel like that's a simplistic comparison, unfair, and not really well thought out.
And Michael, what do we make of Bruce's comment that he thinks that the notion of having your own nation when it suits you and yet being part of this country when it suits you, he doesn't like it. What do you say to that?
I think Peter is more deeply involved with issues of sovereignty. I understand historically what takes place, but I think Pete could actually be a better commenter.
Okay, Peter Jemison?
Well, you know what? In the first place, we had to create a relationship with the Europeans that came here. We had to establish some type of a relationship that we could sort of go back to as we went forward in time. And in one case, we used a simple thing called a wampum belt to establish that there are two distinct people now, and these two people have agreed that they could live in peace and friendship forever if they could respect the right of each to exist. This was an idea that came originally from our Mohawk brothers and sisters as far back as 1613. We tried to apply these same principles when we dealt with the French, when we dealt with English, when we dealt with Americans, to advance that notion that we're not your child, we're your brother, we are brothers. We're all human beings, and we have to find a way to respect this this basic relationship. Then secondly, if you form a government, as the United States did, and that government eventually realizes that unity is essential for them to survive, then we have already received that message, we are already unified. And if we're going to deal with you, the best way for us to deal with you is by a means of a treaty, which is a kind of a contract between human beings about how we're going to conduct ourselves, what land belongs to you, what land you are going to be using, etc. And these are just sort of basic things that has been very difficult for, I guess you could say, the Congress and the government to respect. You know, they don't think that they, for some reason the contract can be broken after a certain period of time. It no longer has validity. We don't believe that way. We believe that if you made that contract, if you made it with the first president of the United States, it's still a valid agreement.
All right, waiting on the phones, Hoover, Ray, Amy, we're going to be getting to you in our second half hour, and we're going to be talking about all the things that the folks out at Ganondagan are so excited about when they open the grand opening of the new Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan on October 24th. It's two Saturdays from now. It's going to be much better weather next weekend, I can tell you that, but they have so much to offer, and we will be covering that as we go throughout this discussion. More of your comments and questions as well with my guests, the historic site manager of Ganondagan, Peter Jemison, and Michael Galbin on the line with us, Ganondagan's historian. More straight ahead right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Dr. John Duffy joins me in studio. He's the author of the new book, The Available Parent. His book aims to help parents communicate much more effectively with their teenagers. And after all, many parents think teenagers seem like aliens, like different people, and the goal is just to get them through the teenage years. Well, what mistakes might parents make, and how do we fix them? That's next hour on Connections.
Brazil may be the soccer capital of the world, but for young women, it is not a level playing field.
When I started playing, I did feel like there was a lot of prejudice. They called me a macho girl. They called me a lesbian.
Brazilian teenage girls fight for the right to play. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and a brief visit from Jean Fisher, my colleague. Hello, Jean.
Hello, Evan, and what a wonderful conversation this has been. I've just been fascinated sitting in my office and thinking to myself, you know, only on public radio can you have this kind of civil discourse where we can bring out all the different viewpoints and have such thoughtful and respectful conversations. And so I appreciate that every day as I listen to Connections, and I hope that you do too. And I want to thank our guests for just, you know, spurring on this amazing conversation. And I also want to let you know that it is listener support that makes this possible. It's listener support that enables us to, you know, have these facilities and microphones and to have Evan here and to have our guests here and to think all of this through and make it come to you over the radio. So no matter where you're listening, if you're in Geneva or Houghton or Rochester or Webster or wherever, I hope that you will take just a moment to make a financial commitment to support the programming. We're not asking for thousands of dollars, unless, of course, you'd like to give thousands of dollars. We won't say no. But to consider maybe $5 a month, $10 a month, $50, $100, and then go online to WRUR.org or to WEOS.org or to WXXI.org. Click on the support button right there on the front page. Make that pledge of support and know with confidence that you are supporting something that is really vital to this community, and that is a forum for this kind of civic dialogue. It's becoming more and more rare. If you tune around the dial and you talk about these kind of issues, you're going to hear a lot of disrespect. You're not going to hear it here. Evan's not going to let it happen. We're not going to let it happen. You are going to hear civil discourse, and that's what your dollars support. So thank you in advance, and let me just give you those websites one more time, WRUR.org, WEOS.org, WXXI.org, or you can call in a pledge at 1-800-295-9994. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Jean. We're talking to Peter Jemison, the historic site manager of Ganondagan, and Michael Galbin, Ganondagan's historian. They have a big day coming up two Saturdays from now. October 24th is the grand opening of the Seneca Art and Culture Center, a year-round multimedia facility with more than 17,000 square feet, historical artifacts, art, exhibits. I want to reel through some of your questions. First of all, our own Karen DeWitt in Albany is already saying, planning a trip to come there. It's great to hear that, and I know a lot of people listening to this right now are probably thinking the same. Barbara Ann on Twitter says, will there possibly be an archaeologist on staff? What would be Peter's picks for opportune digs in our area?
I don't have one. you know, I usually deal with the situations which are created by the idea of development, and then, you know, making sure that we have someone on site who can do a little bit of an overview of what's going on and sort of keep us in the loop.
Okay. And I, again, Barbara, we'll be working through more of what they're going to be having on display in the various exhibits. A question from Brian, who was following up on his concern that modern education is not nearly reflective enough of our own history with Native peoples. He says, I was a Cub and Boy Scout in the Otishiana Council, and he says, right around the corner from Red Jacket, he said, Otishiani was Red Jacket. Anyone else know who he was or what he stood for?
You know, we call him Sagoyawata. And he was really a Seneca leader. You know, he wasn't a chief in the sense that, you know, people kind of think a chief is this great leader and, you know, sort of above the people. And really, that's not the way we think of our leaders. We think of them as we're all equal. Some of us have greater responsibilities than others. You know, Red Jacket lived through an extremely difficult time period when land was being taken from us through treaty and through other means, people coming into our midst. And the important thing is the way it was explained to me, and this comes really more from our oral tradition, is that his responsibility was to basically voice the concerns of the women who wanted to have a voice in our, you know, in our transactions and in our councils and so forth. So they spoke to him, and then he spoke the words that they gave him to say. And so this is probably something people don't even know, you know, is that this isn't a guy who sits around and decides what he thinks he ought to be telling people. He is being told by the women who are very strong in our communities about the things that they're concerned about, what they want protected, and that he should be able to voice those opinions because he had the gift of being a good speaker.
Okay. Amy writes in and wants to know, will the new facility create jobs and what kind? I'm reading, Peter and Michael, that about 45,000 visitors a year currently at Ganondagan, and the forecasts within the first 3 years show a 50% increase. So you're going to be near 70,000 visitors a year at the new Seneca Art and Culture Center. Job creation, Peter?
Yes, there have been some jobs created, and you know, as we're going along now in the training phase of learning the operation of the building, we're beginning to see, you know, what we would really like to have if we had our choice to place new people on our staff. And we'll just have to see how that works out, whether we're able to expand our staff where we really know we're going to need it. And then, you know, there have been a lot of things that have been done. Our staff has expanded a great deal, by the way, already. You know, there are people who are doing one very important job, which is removing the invasive species, the various plants that have taken over the landscape and that are crowding out the native plants. And so we've had a group of people working on that, you know, continuously for the last couple of years, you know, as the weather permitted. They were very helpful to us right now in getting the new plantings in the ground that will be make the center itself more attractive. So they've been very busy. We are training, you should know, this is not a paying job, but we are training docents who will be able to help us with many additional visitors that we'll be getting, and that's one of the jobs that Michael is doing.
Very good. Michael, how's that going?
It's going really well. It's hard to encapsulate, 8,000 years of Seneca presence in the Northeast into half a dozen training days, but we're getting there, and our docents are on the verge of being let loose in the gallery very soon.
Every time we talk Ganondagan and our own history, it's amazing how many questions come in. And I do think it does reflect a lack in our educational system. That's why we have this treasure that's the grand opening 2 Saturdays from now. Allison Wright says, I'm going to bring my children. What's it cost to get in, Peter?
The grand opening is free. There's no charge whatsoever for that day.
Okay, and if you visit after the grand opening, is there a cost to visit?
There is a cost to visit, and forgive me, I am the worst to be able to tell you.
Michael, do you know?
There is, of course, a fee scale on our website, and that will change as the seasons change and the activities that you can, participate in change. Of course, in the wintertime, we closed down our Bark Longhouse reproduction, so that won't be a part of the fee schedule.
What's the website so people like Allison and other listeners can check it out?
GanondaGan.org.
And It's Ganondagan.org if you want to check it out, Allison and others. Gary writes to us and says, in Canada, Indigenous peoples are referred to as first peoples. This implies a sense of fairness. We give way to who is first without judgment of who is better. Thoughts on calling Native Americans first peoples in the United States? Peter Jemison?
Well, I think, you know, the preference, I understand, you know, I think it's First Nations and First People. And I mean, I know the Canadian population is much larger, the Indigenous population, and, you know, there's really been this effort to recognize the people there.
That's Peter's phone. That's all right, Peter. That's
so,
okay.
You know, I understand. I think if anything, you know, here, I think part of it is recognizing how much of our language is in the current lexicon today, because I don't know if people even realize that or where these names came from, you know, but there are so many names in the country and in this area that really come from our people. And so I don't think it's a huge stretch to say, how about if we start to use the name for ourselves, which, for example, as you said, Haudenosaunee, Haudenosaunee. I'm hearing that much more commonly. Before, we were only referred to as the Iroquois, only time when people talked about us. And also, you know, the English, of course, referred to us as the Six Nations. But just getting people educated to the fact that we're talking about the same group of people and that we exist on both sides of this river, which is dividing Canada and the United States.
Six Nations, Onondaga, Cayuga, Seneca, Tuscarora, Oneida, and Mohawk.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay.
Yes.
But is Iroquois, is that a pejorative to you, Peter?
Well, it's a name that came not from us. It's a name that came from people who were not necessarily our friends. I cannot give you the exact definition of that. I've heard a variety of definitions probably over the years, but I don't know. Michael, maybe you want to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, the etymology of Iroquois, it began as a Basque mispronunciation of a word that they had heard when they were in the far northeast, like Bay of Fundy. And it simply meant people to the south, and then sort of got, you know, became locked in people's journals when they wrote the word, and the French heard it and turned it into their version. And so we've been suffering from that totally inaccurate word for 500 years.
So more respectful to go with Haudenosaunee or Haudenosaunee.
Yes, I would say so.
Okay. Back to the phones, and Hoover in Pittsburgh is up next. Go ahead, Hoover. Hello,
I
Hoover.
I want to give you a different interpretation of some of the things you've been talking about. But first, I want to tell Peter and Michael, I'll be at the opening in 2 weeks. I've been watching, drive by, and I've been watching the development. I will be there. And you talked about education and how important it is, and I couldn't agree with you more. One of my college housemates was from Salamanca and a Seneca, and we oftentimes would sit and talk about what he and his family had gone through, and that I learned a lot through firsthand discussion. But also, my daughter and I, we went through, I took her from Rochester to California. She was going to school in Northern California, did an internship at the Seventh Generation program out there, and she was minoring in Native American studies. So I had gone to the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1973 shootout, and I wanted to see what happened there. Met some people that lived there, and I listened and talked and understood it. So when we were driving out to California, she wanted to see the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. So again, we stopped and we looked at it, and we talked to some people and tried to get some firsthand education about what had happened with the FBI and the shootings in Pine Ridge in 1973. But here's the point I want to make, because these things die a very slow death. We were in Sheridan, Wyoming for a couple days. We went into a bookstore, and my daughter asked the woman, she was white hair, older, and she said, do you have any by Native Americans or about Native Americans in that we can look at? And the woman said, if you want those books, go to the library. And so I said, oh, you don't carry them? And she said, no, the SOBs killed my grandparents. I'll never carry their books. So just a different perspective, and it, you know, obviously it dies really very slowly in the West. So I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you, Hoover. Peter, what do you think?
Well, the history is more recent. I mean, You know, the occupation he's talking about is 1973 on the Pine Ridge Reservation. But there's a previous Wounded Knee, which is in the 1800s. And, you know, this is after the Civil War time period, and it's the Army, you know, trying to keep Native people there on reservations and not supplying adequate food and all kinds of other things that, again, many American people know nothing about. And so when someone says that, you know, there were atrocities or there was genocide, many people couldn't put their finger on what is it that they're talking about, what actually happened. And I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I can give you this precise history of events in the West. But again, it is obviously it's a case of people are occupying a certain amount of land. They're using that land. It may not appear so. The landscape may not have been changed dramatically, but they are occupying and using the resources of that land. And along come people who say, you're not making very good use of this. We're going to take it because we need to do whatever it may be, and we need this land in order for us to do that. You know, I mean, even those kind of conversations didn't actually happen that way. It was more of a case of people coming in and simply driving off the people that were living there. I think anyone listening ought to understand the idea that you're going to defend your own homeland. If you're living there and you think someone's coming and forcibly taking it from you, you're going to try to defend your homeland.
Michael Galban, you want to weigh in?
Oh, absolutely. you know, Native people, indigenous people of North, Central, and South America had a way of life. And that way of life was stripped from them. And yet, when the new Americans declare independence, you know, one of the most quoted phrases is that they wanted to preserve life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And Native people were denied that, and our way of life was taken from us. And many people resisted that, and they fought back. And I don't think anyone could blame a person for trying to defend their way of life. So, I mean, that's where I'm at on that.
We've got some information now on the actual general admission prices. Here we go. So,
thank you.
This is Amy Blum helping us out here. General admission continues through the end of this month. So for a couple more weeks out at Ganondagan, it's $8 for adults, $4 for seniors, students age 12 through college, $4. Kids age 5 to 11, $2. And 4 years and younger are free at Ganondagan. And then starting November 1st, the Longhouse is closed, so it goes down to $6 for adults, $3 for seniors and students, $1 for children 5 to 11, and again, free for 4 years and younger. The grand opening, two Saturdays from now, with the event starting at about 10 a.m. That's free all day out at Ganondagan, and that's about a mile south of the Village of Victor. More online at ganondagan.org. Let me grab one more phone call before we turn more to some of the cultural exhibits that will be out there. This is Ray in Rochester who wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Ray.
Good afternoon. I'm really looking forward to the opening of Ganondagan. I've been there several times. But regarding the earlier conversation about Columbus Day, The way that I look upon it is Columbus Day is a celebration of cultural diffusion. So what happened was the two worlds, the Western and Eastern Hemisphere, each had things that the others have benefited from. Now, not to say that there have not been abuses from some of the early explorers. We have to look at things in their historical context. But I really think that that on the whole, that the combination of the two cultures was actually a very healthy thing for mankind, and that it should be celebrated as such. Peter Jennison mentioned that there were papal bulls that basically gave the land away or split it among European powers. Well, there were also bulls that said that the Native Americans were, in fact, human and needed to be treated that way, and that any kind of slavery or forced labor should be ended. And so, again, I think that there's two sides to the story. And then lastly, I have a question. Why don't you go after local municipalities to rename some of the poorly named Native American locations, such as in Irondequoit, there's a Seneca Road and a Seneca Avenue. There's Iroquois School. There are There's Seneca Park. And why not call them Haudenosaunee or call them by more authentic Native name?
Thank you, Ray. Peter?
Well, I guess, you know, there are only so many hours in a day, and right now, our focus has been to get the building built, give us an opportunity to have more people come, and we can really begin the educational process. There are so many different things that people bring to our attention, and, you know, we might love to do it, but it's just the how many people do we have, how much time do we have to focus on the all the different things that actually exist. So, that's the only reason I can give you, Ray, is that it's difficult to do everything we'd like to do.
Brenda writes this. She says, I took my nieces to Ganondagan for the first time a couple of months ago and was blown away by the sheer scope of the place. I've lived here my whole life, and I never realized what a huge and important settlement it was. The history was fascinating. Our guide, I don't remember his name, traced a direct line from the matriarchal culture of the native peoples to Susan B. Anthony and the 19th Amendment. Would your guests expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, our women, especially women who were Onondaga and women who were Seneca and Cayuga, they had a lot of contact with people like Susan B. Anthony, and they had conversations about the fact that our women had been given the rights, the privileges, and the responsibilities that they have a long time ago. You know, Michael mentioned earlier a message of peace. This message of peace, the first person to embrace it was a woman. And she earned for our women this idea of equality, this idea that men and women are equal, that women have certain responsibilities that they must carry out. They have certain responsibilities to make sure that our leaders, quote, the chiefs, act in the best interests of the people. There's a clan mother that heads up each of our clans. We who are Onondaga or Seneca, we have 8 clans. These ideas of equality, the ideas of eating a healthy food and being a part of the decisions about what kind of foods people are eating, the part of how you dress, the ownership of your own home, these very things had a very powerful influence on the suffragettes, who at the time, one expression is, women in the 19th century, white women, were dead in the eyes of the law. They had no rights. They didn't own the clothing on their back. They did not own the right to inherit or have the right to inherit their husband's property. They did not own really or have control over their own children, the children that they had born into this world. I mean, there were so many rights that they didn't have. It's virtually impossible for us to think about this today and believe it, you know. But this is 1924. Big changes came about. And they were, in part, because of conversations, these women, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Susan B. Anthony, had with people that were with women who were living a life of equality.
Amazing. All right, Michael Galvin, got a couple minutes left here. Just remind our listeners what you want them to know about not only the grand opening, but what's to come. Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. Grand opening is 2 Saturdays from now. That's October 24th. Free all day. And when it comes to art, exhibits, et cetera, give us a taste of what's coming up, Michael.
Well, we have a really exciting gallery. Really, the building as a whole affords us opportunity. And when the visitor that we've never had before, when the visitor comes, we have, for example, a theater to listen to the creation story as the Seneca people understand it. They're greeted by 15 different exhibits in a gallery space that's nearly 3,000 square feet. And we're talking about all different aspects of Seneca culture and history, language. It's a very, very vibrant, interactive gallery that I think anybody of any age or interest level is going to come away very, very happy.
All right, we're just about to lose Michael's signal, but Peter, we got a minute left. What are you looking forward to? Go ahead.
What I'm looking forward to is, you know, we have this gorgeous auditorium as well. And the auditorium, we can put on public performances. We can hold lectures there. We can fold up our seating, which is like a theater type of seating, and we can have a very open space for a reception. We can have an open space for a conference, dinner, you know, any variety of things that we would like to do. I think we Now we have, you know, the space to bring people inside during the winter. One thing we didn't mention was that we have a scale model of our Bark Longhouse inside the building. It's 10 feet long and, you know, is outfitted with a lot of beautiful material culture items. And I think that children are going to love that. So it's a beautiful thing. So when we can't take them up to the actual longhouse during the winter, they'll be able to see that and experience it.
I can't wait for my 3.5-year-old to be out there and see it and to continue learning from you. It's ganondagan.org. Two Saturdays from now, the grand opening, the Seneca Art and Culture Center. Michael Galvin, I look forward to the next conversation, and congratulations on the great work out there.
Thank you, Evan.
He's the historian at Ganondagan, and Peter Jemison, always enjoy the conversation and the education. We'll see you out at Ganondagan and back in here soon, I hope.
Thank you, Evan.
Short break and more connections next.